magnetic field being created by that armature and current flowing through those windings. That magnetic field between the armature is having an influence on the stator, and it creates rotation, it creates magnetic energy. So the only wave or field between the armature and the stator of a DC motor is a magnetic field. And energy is flowing through that magnetic field. Does a magnetic field have mass? N2NNU, K2LIW.
All fields have to have mass. Otherwise, they cannot transport energy. It's simple like that.
I agree with it.
Okay, so you're saying a magnetic field has mass. And what do you call the particles of mass of magnetic fields?
Well, that will be for the people of CERN to tell us. This is why we spent $20 billion out there, right?
Oh, KC2, QIQ with a comment.
Just let me have a quick comment.
Yeah, Wesley and Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, I want to support what Glenn said. And I just noticed one simple thing. Electricity flows nearby the vicinity. A magnetic field of the air is nearby vicinity, nearby the surface. Most of the energy is nearby the surface. Glenn, back to you.
Okay, here again, I think we're mixing up what type of energy we're talking about. In other words, there's potential energy and there's kinetic energy. Kinetic energy doing work on a mass, okay? Yes, that's kinetic. That will have some mass associated to it because the energy has to mix with the with some kind of mass to do work or power. But when we're just talking about energy by itself and waves, just open up a physics book and look at the units. In other words, basic units for electromagnetism and electromagnetic and electrostatic fields. You have Oersted, you have Tesla, Gauss. Look at all of these, look at all of the scientific units for every one of these things. There is no mass associated to any of those units because they're just strictly energy units. Perfect example, if you have a magnetic field and you oppose it into a gravity field, the gravity is not going to have any effect on a electromagnetic field. And vice versa, if you just take a dumb piece of mass that's non-magnetic and you put it associated to gravity or otherwise, the two don't interchange. So electromagnetic and gravitational forces are two completely different forces, and if you look at the units, they're completely separate. And you don't need CERN to tell you that. Just open up a physics book and look at the units. The scientific units define what each form of energy is and what the type is. But electromagnetics is one form, and gravitational is another. KC2, QIQ.
Physics books are obsolete. Sorry, Glenn.
Kinetic energy is nearby the surface. Right or wrong?
WA2VDH with a comment.
WA2 Victor Delta Hotel. Start with your name, sir, and then your comment. My name is Dick.
Okay, fine, physicist. Handle is John. Name is John. I just wanted to make a comment about the electromagnetic field and gravitational field, in that a gravitational field will cause the bending of an electromagnetic field. A light, for example, can be bent by a gravitational field when there's an eclipse. There's been observed the apparent shifting of the planet Mercury as its light passes close to the sun. Go ahead.
AC2, QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, John. The gravity lensing effect that the astronomers are seeing rather frequently in their astronomy measurements shows you that a gravitational field will interfere very weakly with an electromagnetic field. I'll wait for the beep. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely, it will. And it's not because the gravity is affecting the electromagnetic field, because, there again, the units don't match. But there is, in space, particles. And we know that particles have mass, and light will pass through particles. And the light that intersects the particles on the way over will definitely have an effect, sometimes blurring, sometimes bending effects, to gravitational forces. But the electromagnetic and electrostatic fields will not. KC2, QIQ.
N2H with a comment.
NY2H with a comment.
NY2H and XJN. Hold on now. Are you telling me, Glenn, that it's only the particle field around the sun that bent that wave coming from Mercury? Are you telling me it's only the particle field around a massive set of galaxies that's creating the gravity lensing effect? That you're telling me it's really a refractive optics phenomena and not gravity field? Right now, the physicists that are looking at the spatial situation are saying that Einstein is implying that there is a bending of space in that area. The gravity field is creating this bending of space, and that's what's creating the lens effect, not the particles around the galaxy. How come every one of these galaxies, once you know the mass of the galaxy, you know the amount of light bending you're going to get? Are we trying to say that they all have the exact same field of particles that's creating this deflection, very similar to a refraction effect, like an ordinary physical lens? Is that what you're saying, Glenn? Glenn First, KC2QIQ, K2RW?
Well, I think there's two things involved here. One is there's a particle effect, and secondly, there's a time effect. You know, it's time and distance. When you're looking at light over certain lengths of time, there's a point in which your viewing of the light and the delay or the depth of field of the light are two completely different things. And when the two don't necessarily, or the depth of field from the viewing points can differ, and that will also cause a bending effect.
Okay, sounds like Wesley wanted to say something on this. Wait for the beep. Go ahead, Wesley.
I remember when I spoke with Glenn and with you, and I asked you, does the electromagnetic wave has the mass, has the weight? And in response to that, you said, no. At least I understood this this way. And charged particles from the sun trapped in the Earth's magnetic field crash into the atmosphere, create aurora. And the effect of that is luminance. Then the electromagnetic waves from 80 meters bent are bendable more than the shorter one. Now, that's what Alex said. Everything has to have a mass. And that's what I would like to add into that. Also, I would like to ask that question. Hold on a moment. Glenn said that self-oscillation has all properties of over unity, like the self-oscillation in the circuit when you have overdriven your amplifier. Then what could be done to control that but sustain oscillation? And how would you picture such a circuit? Back to you, Dekandoje.
Before I try to answer that one, let me pick up. I think it's Lou. NY2H wanted to make a comment. NY2H, go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. No, you beat me to it. I was going to mention the bending of space as the phenomenon that caused the gravitational lens effect. But you got me.
Out of curiosity, Lou, you live in Port Jefferson. You sound very good tonight. I should know, but are you coming in the eastern input or the western input?
Yeah, I'm coming in on the east. I live in Port Jeff. I'm in Medford now. My girlfriend's town. Actually, I was sitting in the driveway listening. But to the eastern link.
Okay, now we know why you sound so good. When it comes to a sustained oscillation, believe it or not, when you take a amplifier, usually with a tuned circuit, you take some of the output signal, feed it back to the input of your amplifier, and if you trace that path around that loop, and if that loop has greater than unity gain, with the correct phase shift at the frequency you care about, then by definition you have an oscillator. Greater than unity gain, correct phase shift at your desired frequency is an oscillator. And you would think that when an amplifier is in oscillation, that the oscillation will dominate, create a limiting effect within the amplifier. It does. And you would think that it no longer serves a useful purpose of amplification. You take, for instance, Kerry Banky. I'm having trouble thinking of his call letters, from San Diego. He set up a beautiful so-called F1 repeater on 10 gigahertz in San Diego, or on one of the mountains of San Diego. Let me drop. An exciting project. I'll describe it to you. What he's literally got is an antenna on top of a tower that looks out to the horizon. It's got an omnidirectional pancake-shaped pattern looking out to the horizon. That's the receiving antenna. The signal picked up by the receiving antenna goes through approximately 70 decibels of gain, and then comes out a second antenna mounted 20 feet further up on the tower. And that second antenna has another pancake pattern aimed at the horizon. So here's a repeater that has input frequency and the output frequency, that's the same. You stand on the street in San Diego and transmit a 10 gigahertz signal toward that mountain. Out comes a signal 70 decibels stronger, and the repeater has no real frequency to it. You can feed it a frequency at 10.1 gigahertz or 10.5 gigahertz. It'll give that signal 70 dB of gain, and it comes out stronger. And now a person on the other side of the mountain hears you, or a person somewhere else behind a building in San Diego will hear you. Beautiful system. And it's stable until a cloud comes along. A cloud comes along, and now the signal being transmitted by the upper antenna bounces off the cloud, comes back to the lower antenna, and that whole path has greater than unity gain, and the system is going into oscillation. And maybe it's 80 dB of gain. And he's got a way of remotely programming the gain up and down with a step attenuator that he can remotely control to control the situation from day to day. Suddenly realized, Kerry realized, he doesn't have to control the gain. If the amplifier, if that repeater system goes into oscillation, and he looks at a spectrum analyzer that's set very wide, he realizes that the frequency of oscillation is jumping all over the place randomly as that cloud undulates and the reflection characteristic in amplitude and phase changes. So the oscillation of that system is jumping all over the place. When you listen with any reasonable receiver, you do not hear the oscillation. And when you transmit your signal through that repeater while it is oscillating, you still hear your beautiful signal amplified, but instead of it having 70 dB of gain yesterday and the cloud is there today, it's got 68 dB of gain. You lose about 2 dB of gain when the loop gain has more than 2 dB of excess gain, which sends it into oscillation. By definition, an amplifier in oscillation goes into limiting, but it only goes into limiting by the magnitude by which it is excess in gain to sustain the oscillation. So it still has, at every other frequency, even other frequencies where it's oscillating, so to speak, so oscillation on that system almost doesn't matter. Kind of magic, and it makes you think very differently about repeaters, and Kerry is proposing to put a whole repeater.
Time out.
Kerry is proposing to put a whole string of those repeaters along the California coast and have them all talk to each other. So what happens in oscillation, what happens with energy being feedback from the output to the input, and by the way, in my opinion, that is not above unity circuit. It is not, although it's above unity and gain, you're not getting free energy in that system because he's got a power supply feeding those amplifiers that are creating the 70 decibels of gain, and every milliwatt of power output or microwatt or watt of power output of that final amplifier is coming from his power supply. So he's not getting something for free, but it does give you another way of looking at oscillation, gain, free energy, excess power coming out of an amplifier, and so on. I know this is a little bit left of center, but I just thought it was kind of interesting. Over to you, Wesley. And by the way, after Wesley's next comment, we're going to go over to the other three people who've signed in. We'll go to them, their questions, and then we'll come back to the subject. Into XJN for a final on this subject for now, K2RIW. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, into XJN. I just want to hear what Glenn has to say about it, and also just what I said about the aurora and the waves, and you respond that electromagnetic wave does not have a weight. You do not say that, and thank you very much. It was a pleasure to pick up the subject with you and to share.
Yeah, for the people listening, you can tell that this particular subject, we're not going to complete it anytime soon. We're going to take it a bite at a time. We'll spend a certain amount of time on it on each TechNet until we're all relatively happy. Hopefully we'll all come to a slightly higher understanding of what Mother Nature is telling us about the laws of physics. Ain't simple. The next person who signed in, I think, was Bill, KC2 Sierra Yankee Lima. Hope you're still there, Bill. Go right ahead with your question, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, and good evening to the net. Yes, I am still here. I have two questions and possibly a third comment about the previous discussion. I'm in the process of still exploring antennas, and I have a Yagi antenna on my roof, which is mounted on a TV antenna, which the previous owner of the home had placed on there on the mast. I'm looking at the antenna handbook, and I'm looking at the diagram of the Yagi antenna for 432 megahertz. As far as I can determine, the dimensions are about the same. I cannot physically get to the antenna as it's on the roof and the roof slope and so on. But the question is, would I be able to use this antenna, if indeed it is a 432 megahertz Yagi, for transmission out of my handy-talkie? Back to you, Dick.
And I presume you're talking about a 432 megacycle or a 450 megacycle handy-talkie. There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, as I see it, Bill. First of all, if the Yagi in question is known to have reasonable standing wave ratio and reasonable gain at your particular frequency, let's assume that you're a 432 megacycle single sideband operator and the calling frequency is 432.100. And whether you feed it with a base station rig or a handy talkie doesn't matter. It should work like a charm. In fact, when I do something wrong with the transmitter you're listening to right now, my Kenwood TS711A, which is sitting on the desk, and I do something wrong and it goes into a failure mode, I disconnect the cable from the back of that rig, connect it into my handy talkie, and continue talking for a while until this rig comes back to normal operation. So feeding a handy talkie through a cable up to an antenna, perfectly normal thing to do. There's one slight catch to that now. Two catches. Number one, if you happen to be near a very strong source of signals in the frequency region, like a taxi cab dispatching center is next door to you, a handy talkie doesn't have anywhere near the front end filtering of a desktop radio, and therefore the handy talkie could easily experience front end overload and give you some funny performances when it's receiving, when the taxi cab transmitter is transmitting nearby. Second of all, when it comes to the 432 band, it really is two separate bands. 432-100 approximately are where the sideband horizontally polarized people dwell. The so-called 450 portion of the band, where the FM vertically polarized people dwell, is more like 445 to 449 point something megacycle in that frequency region. Many Yagis that are well tuned to 432 will give you a pretty strong standing wave ratio at 449, for instance. A 432 Yagi with a 1.1 standing wave ratio at 449 might give you 2.5 standing wave ratio, and maybe your particular rig wouldn't be happy with it. So there's really sort of two bands or two kinds of service, different in polarization and different in frequency range, and some Yagis of some designs are not broadband enough. But when in doubt, almost all of the transmitters we can use these days, Bill, have a built-in protect circuit. If it sees a high standing wave ratio, the final detection circuit will either go into a self-protect mode where it stops transmitting or goes to a lower power output. Very few of the modern-day transmitters get damaged because they're looking into a high standing wave ratio. And when in doubt, you can borrow somebody's standing wave ratio meter or their bird watt meter, measure forward power and reverse power coming out of, say, your handy-talkie into that antenna. While you tune the handy-talkie to various frequencies, you can find out what is the reflected power ratio plot it up as standing wave ratio once you do the conversion, and find out what that antenna is really doing. So I think there's a 98% chance that antenna will do what you want on the 432 band if that's where it was designed. KC2SYL, K2LIW, the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thanks, Dick. I think the antenna was originally put up there to receive transmissions from the TV band, but I could be wrong. It could have been, a business band. I don't have, once again, I don't have access to the antenna, but I plan to use a Kenwood TH6, which is a handy talkie on the lowest power. This second question about the antenna is, it looks like it's fed by 75 ohm coaxial cable. I cannot see a number on it, but I suspect that's what it is. And would I do any damage to my transceiver if I connected the antenna from the transceiver to the Aggie antenna through that 75 ohm cable? I just did a little experiment on low power to see how it works. And additionally, I have attached the scanner, not a receiving only scanner, to the antenna, and I'm able to receive signals from all over, directional, obviously, but I'm able to receive quite nicely. Back to you, Dick.
There's a number of subjects there, Bill. Receivers are usually amazingly forgiving. A receiving circuit, a scanner, spectrum analyzer, your ham radio receivers, they're very, very tolerant. You could have a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio of an antenna system connected to your receiver, and your receiver will continue to receive beautifully, except it may have, let me pick a number, 3 or 5 dB less sensitivity because of the standing wave ratio, but nothing bad happens. Now, if that antenna was made for the business band of 450, which really is around 465 megacycles, the chances of it having good performance way down at 432 or 445 when it was designed for 465, that's kind of slim. You also mentioned the word television band. If it's a UHF television receiving antenna, which in the old days was designed for 470 to 890 megacycles, the chances of that having good performance down in the ham band, either portion of the ham band, is pretty slim. To receive on it, no problem. To transmit on it, I think you're going to hear fairly high standing wave ratio. And again, you can make a measurement for that, but in the low power mode, almost every rig is self-protected. Most of them, even in the high power mode, will self-protect. The fact that it's fed with maybe 70 ohm cable versus 50 ohm cable, that's an extremely minor issue. Right now, you're listening to me talking to you on 70 ohm hardline. The cable I've got going up my 100 foot tower is 70 ohm, 3/4 inch CATV type hardline. That's what's feeding the Yagi antenna you're listening to right now. 70 ohm versus 50 ohm, even if the antenna was perfectly 50 and the cable was 70, you end up with a 1.5 standing wave ratio. And if you wanted to be really a purist, if you were a moon bouncer, let me drop, and you wanted that last tenth of a dB of performance, you could build, by various techniques, an impedance matching circuit. A piece of approximately 62 ohm cable. If you put a quarter wavelength of 62 ohm cable in between your 50 ohm transmitter and your 70 ohm antenna, that's a quarter wave matching transformer. The output end will look like 70 ohms, the input end will look like 50 ohms, and everything's hunky-dory. So you could build a simple or a more complicated impedance converting device. You don't have to. 70 ohm cable, in fact, 70 ohm cable in general has lower loss than 50 ohm cable, so you come out ahead. That's one of the reasons why cable TV systems are 70 ohms and most television aerials are 70 ohms. So if that's truly a 70 ohm, if that's truly a television aerial, the chances of it giving you good performance on ham radio is slim, but that's not a showstopper. Go ahead and use it and find out. The chances of you creating damage to the final stage of your transmitter is fairly low. And even if you do damage that final stage, you got a real smart guy named Andy, WA2CDL, who can fix anything. If you're unwilling to change that final stage yourself, you could easily talk him into it, the guy who runs the the technical sessions for tune-up of rigs on this particular repeater system every time they have a flea market or a get-together, and there's one coming up in the end of February. KC2SYL, K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. I think you've encouraged me to try that experiment, at least with a low power on my handy talkie and connect it directly to the 70R cable, to the antenna and so on. Second question, are you still open on discussion about the Toyota problem? I have a report, I drove down to Florida, and I'd like to give a report on that if you're so inclined. So back to you, Dick.
I'm definitely so inclined, and I want to hear about your report. And there's been quite a few reports that I've heard during this last week on the so-called Toyota problem. I've got a lot of comments on it. Because the Toyota problem is, in my words, in my mind, a life-threatening problem, even though it's a little bit off to one side of ham radio, a good number of us operate mobile ham radio. And we're so busy with the radio, the nuances of how the Toyota machine that we might own behaves and whether or not we can prepare ourselves ahead of time for the minor eventuality of the runaway throttle problem. I've got a lot of comments on that. Let me hear your comments first, Bill. Yes, it is, Bill. KC2SYL, what did you find out on your trip to Florida? K2RIW in the TechNet. Do you own one of those, by the way?
Info on that subject to FLS.
FLS recognized. Go ahead, Bill, first.
Thanks, Dick. We own a Lexus, but we didn't take the Lexus to Florida. I was a driver for a friend of mine who needs to get out of the cold weather for various medical reasons, and he owns a Toyota. It's a 2007 Camry, a very nice vehicle. We drove it three legs to the trip. We drove it from New York, from our homes here in New York, to North Carolina, stayed overnight there. North Carolina to South Carolina, where we stayed with friends of ours, and in South Carolina to our ultimate destination in North Fort Myers, where I stayed a couple of days, and he is still down there. The first leg of the trip on 95, I drove part of the way, obviously, and he drove part of the way. Cruise control, no problem. Without cruise control, no problem. We didn't experience any abnormal acceleration. Everything worked as it was supposed to work. Same idea with the trip, the second day trip from North Carolina to South Carolina. Various speeds on the interstate, anywhere from 40 miles an hour out of cities to the speed limit, using both cruise control and the pedal. The accelerator pedal. No obvious changes. And the third part of the trip from South Carolina to Fort Myers, the same idea. I'm going to let it drop for a minute, and I'll be back. So on the interstate portion, combination of high-speed driving and low-speed driving around metropolitan areas, the three legs of the trip were uneventful and actually very pleasant. In the North Fort Myers area, where I stayed for about a week, we did some local driving, both under cruise control when it allowed and normal city traffic, stop and go and so on, and no abnormal effects at all. Everything worked as it should. I did perform an experiment that if the automobile accelerated, out of control, it would take approximately 1 or 2 seconds to put it into neutral. But the problem is that you really can't see clearly where the key is. I know one of the solutions is to turn off the key. And that may be, under stress, that may be very difficult to do the two-step process of putting the car into neutral and then turning off the key. As a side note, I'm going to let it drop. I have another comment on this or another report. When we found out about the recall via the internet, we drove to a local Toyota dealer, a pretty large Toyota dealer in the Fort Myers area, and we went into the service area to find out what the situation was. And it was a day after, or 2 days after, that it appeared in the press. The folks in the Toyota dealership, this particular Toyota dealership, hadn't heard about it yet. So the news got out to the media before the the dealers found out about it. This was a week and a half ago. Back to that.
One quick question. Your Lexus is what year, Bill?
06.
And I think 06 might be in the recall period. So you had no incident. And let me report to people that I think that this is a relatively rare incident. Maybe it's one vehicle per 10,000 or whatever. However, when it happened, if you didn't prepare yourself ahead of time, neutral first, Endor may be turning off the key, and there's mixed emotions on that one. If you leave the key on while it's in neutral, you still have, and the engine is running, and who cares if the engine is running super fast, it has an over-rev limit built into its computer, and even if it didn't, it's got hydraulic lifters that are going to float. So the engine is, it's going to be noisy as all hell, but it's limited in how much RPM it'll go to in neutral with a stuck accelerator. But with the engine running, you still have power steering, and maybe you've got some brakes. However, if you do use the brakes in the condition, do not pump the brakes, because what little vacuum you've got is what's left in the vacuum reservoir. With the accelerator wide open, there no longer is any vacuum being generated by that carburetor. So it cannot recharge that vacuum reservoir that runs your power brake system. In the worst case scenario, you might go down to manual brakes, which is a hell of a lot less efficient, less forceful than the power brakes when the vacuum is there. So do not pump. And as I said, there's mixed emotion. Neutral first, and consider turning off the engine. I think the latest recommendation is use the brakes once, continuously, to stop the vehicle, then turn off the engine. I've got a lot more to say about this one, but let's see what, I think it's Howard's got to say. N2FLS, go right ahead, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, guys. This is Mark, N2FLS. How you doing? Listen to a radio station, 90.3, this morning, called Motormouth Radio, and about an hour. They're on Thursdays and Sundays, and they talk about cars and stuff. You call them with questions or whatever. Anyway, that was one of the topics. Basically, there's a company called CTS who makes this pedal sensor, I think it was called. I forget the exact name of it, but whatever. And they subbed it out to a company in Canada. And what happens, if you look at your VIN number, if I remember correctly, if it starts with a J, the car is made in Japan, you don't have any problem. If it starts with a number, you probably do have a problem. And there's a second way to tell if you have the problem sensor. Oddly enough, the gas pedal, if it has, in the design of it, some of them have like long rips to it, you get the beep if it exists. Okay, I guess not. If it's, if your gas pedal has four ribs, you have no problem. If it's a seven-rib gas pedal, oddly enough, that dictates you have the CTS sensor in it. And that's pretty much what I had to say, Dick.
Comment.
Go ahead, comment.
Interjection. I spoke to the professional who works with Toyotas, and remember what I told you about that foot under the pedal to try to push back. And he told me, because I said various numbers of vehicles and the newer one, the older one, and he told me, if you feel when you're on cruise control that your pedal goes mechanically down, you can use the foot under the pedal to pull it out. But if you don't see that it's happening, then you don't have this option. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if I had a runaway engine problem, and by the way, this price, as of this week, is now affecting Toyota, Lexus, and Prius vehicles. Quite a few of them since numbers like 2005 and 2006 and later in the United States, they have stopped essentially all manufacture of those cars until they get to the bottom of this problem. They have now begun to recall vehicles not only in the United States, but also in Europe and Japan. So this is now becoming a much more international situation. The 4 million vehicles that we've been hearing about that are going to be recalled, I think the number is now up to 6 million vehicles. I'm hearing numbers like $500 million per month are going to be lost because of all of these recalls and whatever. And I know that Almost all of the rental car services have removed those particular vehicles from their parking lots. You can no longer rent those vehicles. Now, they are probably being ultra-conservative. Quite possibly they're not willing to take the risk of the liability of having a rental person run into one of these conditions with that vehicle. But if you're a private owner of one of those recalled vehicles, I would not, my understanding is I would not stop driving the vehicle. I would just make sure that I have practiced, that I have the ability to get it into neutral. Your greatest protection when it happens is getting it into neutral. And now I've got a couple of comments as to how I think we got here from there. And that is, you've all heard of Moore's Law, M-O-O-R-E, one of the founding people from the Intel Corporation. Way back in the late 60s, he wrote an article saying that the number of transistors that you've got in an integrated circuit will double every 18 months. He made that prediction approximately 1970. He made a parallel prediction that the number of lines of code that you use in microprocessors that are in consumer products, whether it be your electric shaver, your television set, your microwave oven, or the emission, the energy control engine control unit for your automobile, in general, all consumer products, the number of lines of code doubles every 2 years. And if you plot this out, and if you go to Moore's Law and you go to Google and you look at the Wikipedia search on that, you'll be amazed how beautiful a curve they present that goes all the way up to the year 2010 and how well that law matches the reality. Beautiful plot. So, as computers get more and more complicated, the possibility of a computer giving you a glitch increases. The automatic baggage handling system in Boulder, Colorado is a classic example where it was costing them $1 million a day because of software glitches in that automatic handling, baggage handling system. Every one of us has used a computer that sometimes goes into a hang-up mode, and we have to reboot the computer. And if that computer is the engine control unit of your particular automobile, and it sees a glitch from somewhere and goes into a hang-up mode, the only thing that would protect you from that is if it thinks that the accelerator is all the way to the floor, and it's not, the only thing that's going to protect you, for you to be protected, is to be able to go into neutral and practice that and know how to get every one of your vehicles into neutral if you have to. And the only other thing that would protect you is if they installed a so-called watchdog timer, where the watchdog timer recognizes the fact that there is a particular signature of the way the computer is behaving when it's one of its hang-up modes. And if the programmers were smart enough to think of every possible hang-up mode and would teach the watchdog timer a separate circuit in the computer that when you find this condition, it's in a glitch, it's in a hang-up mode, and do a reboot. And how long does it take to do a reboot? Hopefully it's only milliseconds, because if your engine control computer is doing a reboot for some ridiculous length of time while you're driving at 60 miles an hour or higher, that doesn't sound completely safe. Again, you have to be able to have the ability to go into neutral. Whether or not the company who is building the actual gas pedal operation, or the company building the servo mechanism that's in the throttle body itself, and whether or not they're at fault is very questionable. In other words, no one knows for sure what's going on here. By some means, the computer is getting a command to accelerate, and is it a phony command issued by the gas pedal sending unit in this so-called fly-by-wire system? In the old days, you used to have a complete mechanical linkage between your gas pedal and the carburetor. That linkage no longer is there. It's now an electronic command. That's why they call it fly-by-wire. That is required because we have stricter and stricter rules on the emissions you're allowing out of an automobile. We have stricter and stricter rules as to what gas mileage you've got to get, under what conditions. So therefore, the computer is doing a very complicated job of looking at the oxygen sensor, looking at the temperature, humidity, the command, the load, and so on, whether or not you're going up a hill, and all these kind of things. It's got to make a lot of calculations and adjustments, as way beyond what you can do with simple mechanical linkage. Adjust the pulse width modulation of your fuel injectors and so on. A lot of action is going on. So we need that computer. But as the computer has more and more lines of code, doing a more and more complicated job, it's going to have to have these protection mechanisms built into it. One more job. Audi had this problem something like 15 years ago, runaway accelerators. Audi solved the problem by putting in a circuit which recognized that when the driver touches the brake pedal, that command dominates over everything else, and the computer knows that the brake pedal has been pressed, and it demands that the engine be at idle speed while the brake is being pressed. So even if the engine is in a runaway condition, it is commanded to be idle when the brake pedal is pressed. That, according to Audi, was the best possible protection. But here's the problem. Each individual automobile manufacturer has proprietary information as to the design of their particular automobiles. It's a competitive business. It's not shared information. Therefore, that shared solution that Audi found was not shared by the rest of the automobile industry. And apparently, the Toyota and Toyota products didn't get the message. And that particular protect mechanism is not there. Now, the thing that's disappointing me is that what I'm hearing is that during these recalls, they're going to shorten the gas pedal. They're going to make sure that the floor mat has a cutout so it can't possibly create a jamming. I'm afraid that that may not be enough because a number of these incidents occurred with the floor mat in the trunk of the car. So a stuck pedal and the length of the pedal, it's a fix, but I'm not sure it's the right fix. I don't think it's enough. And in some cases, they're going to change the sending unit. But still, the computer can make the glitch, and the right solution is the so-called Audi fix, in my mind. That is to say, the recognizing the brake pedal being touched. Unfortunately, that's a lot of change of computers, software, interfacing connectors, and whatever. Can they get enough of that installed early enough during these first recalls? I think the answer is no. I think the Audi fix, which is the Cadillac fix, so to speak, I'm not convinced we're going to get that at first. I think we're going to get that later in the recalls, because I don't think they can supply enough computers unless it happens to be a read-only memory chip that can simply be changed. I hope it is, and that way the Audi fix is possibly being added to the Toyota vehicles. If not, you're going to be getting only a change in the gas pedal and the gas pedal sending unit and instructions to go into neutral. I'm glad to see that the news media is finally telling us that neutral is the major solution. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this, give me a call at us, KQRIW in the tech desk. Okay, enough of the Toyota problem tonight, and we'll be discussing that more as time goes on. And it will be interesting to find out if we're getting the Audi fix or just a change in gas pedal physical length, the cutout in the rug, and the change of the sending unit for the gas pedal, which some people think. What's going on here is that if it was the hang-up of the computer, maybe it's something that happens one event in 10,000. Murphy's Law dictates that when you try to investigate one of these situations, of course it will not do it when you want to do the test, and therefore it's very difficult to do a confirmation. However, many of these automobiles do have a recording device on board. We go back and read past events of velocity, time, date, and so on. I'd like to believe by reviewing that data, we stand a chance of finding out what was really going on in some of these accidents. And I'm hearing crazy numbers as to the number of accidents that occurred. What really kicked it off is that highway patrol officer in California way back in November. We wouldn't have found out what happened other than that he and his family died if it wasn't one of his family members in the car on the cell phone on 911 hollering Mayday. And therefore, the recording of that conversation of the vehicle going 110 miles an hour with the man standing on the brakes with a Lexus automobile, 2009 Lexus, that was loaned to him by his automobile repair shop because his car was being repaired and this vehicle he wasn't familiar with was loaned to him. It had a keyless ignition. He didn't know that you had to press the starter button and hold it for 3 seconds to kill the engine. He didn't know that to get it into neutral, you had to jiggle the shift lever in a particular manner, because in that particular Lexus vehicle, the manufacturer was afraid that somebody touching the floor shift with their elbow would kick it into neutral by mistake, and they made it more difficult for it to go into neutral. You have to learn the procedure of getting your vehicle into neutral. He didn't have those two pieces of information, and he and his three family members all died, unfortunately. That's what kicked it off. But there's been quite a few other situations. And on the TechNet, when we discussed this about a month ago, there were a number of people who signed in who have already run into the problem. So tell everyone you know, if they've got one of these vehicles, to learn how to put it into neutral. That's the major solution. Without being told that, the average person, let me drop, does not think of the right solution. It is not common sense. We've got a whole lot of very smart people who signed into this TechNet. When I approached this problem 1 month ago and I asked people what would they do, a tremendous number of people told me they're going to put it into park. I said, that's not the right solution. To get it into park, you have to go from drive through neutral, through reverse, into park on a high-speed vehicle. A lot of things can happen there wrong. I told them I strongly disagreed with that. Then a lot of people came back to me saying, well, whenever you're going down a hill and you want to go slower, you put it into low second gear or first gear. You go into lower drive. That's not the right solution. Because when the engine is flat out running at 6,500 RPM, and if you can get it all the way down to second gear or first gear, you're still moving 40 miles an hour forward, and now you triple the torque to the wheels, you absolutely guarantee that the brakes are not going to be able to stop you. That guarantees that whatever you're going to hit, you're going to hit it at 40 miles an hour. That's not the right solution. Until we discussed it, back and forth, arguing with each other for quite a period of time, I wasn't getting among this smart group of people the consensus of opinion that neutral was the right solution. It really disappointed me. It told me the problem is a lot more serious. It's a human interface problem, a lot more serious than first meets the eye, because it's not common sense until you've thought about it ahead of time. Okay, enough on that one. The next person who signed in, I think, was Ed, K2 Golf Juliet Echo. If you're still there, Ed, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think Ed is not there. Paul, WS2N, wonder if you go in one of these vehicles and what's going on in space these days. WS2N, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a quick comment, though, Dick.
Okay, stand by, Paul. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just if you get a chance later, Dick, look on Wikipedia for gravitational lenses. There's an excellent article that they have on that, and they show a simulation in the middle of that part of that webpage where they show a background light that's coming from a distant galaxy passing around a black hole as the simulation goes across, and you can see the effect that it's basically having on the light wave as it goes through. And as it passes through the black hole, you can see that none of the light wave is getting absorbed into the black hole. It just reproduces itself as a ring and lenses around the outside and then is recreated on the other side completely unaffected. KC2QIQ, interesting thing to check out.
Agreed. And the cosmologists are all calling it gravity lensing effect, and they explain it as gravity bending the wave. They have... the cosmology reports that I have read, Glenn, have not said that the local particle field around the high gravity object, that the local particle field is bending the wave. They said the gravity itself is bending the wave. Over to you for a comment on that, Glenn.
Well, I think that's also a little bit of semantics, because what's happening is if there's a black hole in the way of your viewing area in space and time, then obviously nothing could be viewed for an area where there's a hole opening. So the only place where it could be viewed is around the outside. So technically you could say, yes, it's bending around the outside, but the fact that the wave passes to the other side and it's completely unaffected when it's outside of the range of the lensing, it basically is kind of saying that there's no real effect on it other than the viewing, which is that's why I believe it's called a lensing effect, not the black hole absorbing the gravity of the wave and drawing it into the black hole.
Okay, there are a number of photographs done by the Hubble Space Telescope where a single point source of light, which is a very far off quasar or very distant galaxy, which is going to give you essentially a point source of light. You see that point source of light as 3, 4, 5, or 10 individual light sources that appear to be around the perimeter of the heavy gravity object. You see the real object multiple points, multiple times, displaced in angle to the left and to the right of the high gravity object, above and below the high gravity object, and quite a number of millidegrees off to one side, outside of the local field of that high gravity object. And in the case of a parallax situation where motion is involved, where either the distant galaxy or the local, the slightly closer high gravity object is in motion, the apparent position of the distant object, the apparent position, shifts as the high gravity object moves. I think it is the gravity effect itself, not the particles around the perimeter of, let's say, the black hole. Over to you, Glenn.
No, I agree exactly with what you're saying, but you know, it's just breaking it back down to an electromagnetic or an electrostatic wave. Is the wave being drawn into the black hole, or is it the particle that's being drawn into the black hole? That's what I think the real question is, and I still have my doubts that the electromagnetic wave is being drawn in. I mean, certainly any particles would be, anything like that, but being that the wave is constituted, again, on the outside or the ring or the perimeter, kind of demonstrates that, in other words, if there's any mass near it, it gets drawn in, but basically it almost looks as if it's being deflected, not, in other words, because if the wave has to pass through or around it because it's being unaffected by gravitation, it just reinforces again on the other side.
I'm going to add a couple words to that. The source of the light of a very distant object, it's usually a fairly bright, very distant object, that light is spreading out in all directions. It is radiating. Some of that light normally would have passed relatively far to the left or to the right of the high gravity object. And the light that passed in that particular direction normally would go far to your left and my and your right, and you would never see it. But now, because of the bending of that wave that would have missed you, now bends around that gravity field and now comes back in the direction toward you, is the reason why you see it, and you see it from the wrong location. Very similar to what happens when the sun has set, but the bending of the atmosphere, and now that's refraction, pure dielectric effect refraction. You see the sun when it's really below the horizon, but you see it above the horizon. By the same token, you're seeing the light of the distant object in the position where it is not located, because that light that would have missed you is now brought back toward you as it passes by the high gravity object. Pure gravity field appears to be doing that, according to the reports from the cosmologists I have read. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And here again, I agree. But I think there again, you keep on throwing that word in again about, you know, diffraction, and which is, there again, diffraction means a medium change, that there's some mass or gas or something around the outside that's actually causing that effect. But just the electromagnetic wave itself, is it really being bent because of gravity? I don't think so. I think what we're doing is, from our viewing effect, it's we're seeing the effects on the particles around the outside, but not necessarily the wave.
Comments?
You said diffraction, but you meant refraction. In the case of seeing the sun below the horizon, that is refraction by local dielectric effect of the atmosphere being more dense close to the ground than it is above the ground. That is pure dielectric refraction. But there's also gravity lens refraction when it comes to the gravity lensing effect. I think that is refraction created by a local gravity field, irrespective of particles in that area where you're seeing the light of the distant object. You think it is particle scattered or refracted, a wave refracted by the particles. Or maybe you're saying diffracted by the particles. There's diffraction, refraction, reflection. And we're not talking about, we could also be talking about reflection off the particles if they're out there. I don't think reflection is it. I don't think diffraction is it. I think refraction, but there's more than one kind of refraction. Gravity lensing refraction, dielectric field, in the case of the sun below the horizon refraction. Go ahead, comment, K2RIW.
Yeah, absolutely, Jake. I mean, I'm agreeing with you here again, because I think what's happening is that when we're looking at the sun's effect on the horizon, that we're looking at through the atmosphere, so we're seeing the bending due as it passes through the atmosphere, and that's a gas or a mass. So that's what we're seeing the bending effect associated to. And I believe when we're looking into deep space black holes and we're looking at electromagnetic waves as light going around a black hole or a galaxy, we're seeing those effects because of that. But when the wave is clearly on the other side, it's totally unaffected again. So we're seeing a lensing effect. But to say that actually the black hole is absorbing or drawing it in, why would we see the energy around the perimeter and not through the center? If you follow what I'm saying, why would it just be like a black spot? In other words, normally if there's just something, mass or something blocking something, usually you would just see a blank spot in that area and you'd see the wave on either side. But the fact that it's going, the lensing effect that it's going, I'm almost saying the opposite. It's saying that because it can't exist there, it's basically going in where the gas or the mass of the particles are around the outside until it clears and comes around on the other side, if you follow what I'm saying. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the two of you doubled at first, and Glenn won out. Yes, I know for a fact the light is not going to go through the black hole. No doubt on that one. I think it was Wesley. Go ahead, Wesley.
But just asking Glenn, did he mean when he said that the electromagnetic waves were not affected by the gravitational pull?
Good question. Is the gravity component of the high gravity object, is the gravity component affecting the light wave of the distant object? Yes or no, in your opinion, Glenn?
Well, here again, if the light wave is in a pure vacuum, my answer is no. If it's mixed with particles, like if the light is going through a gas, the answer would be yes. Because the gas, like when you put light through a gas and you have a gravitational effect on the gas will warp and change the effect or the wave of the light because the medium is changing. But if it's just in a pure vacuum, in other words, if you're just in open space and the light is going through it and you put a gravitational force next to it, my belief is that no, there's no gravitational effect on the light wave without the effect of some gas or particles mingling with the light wave.
Then there is no pure vacuum. The particles are everywhere in a pure vacuum. They are particles from the Big Bang. There is nobody who found better theory. Back to you, Glenn.
Hold on a minute now. Well, we've got a problem here, Glenn, of pure coincidence. By way of Einstein's theory, which was predicated on the warping of space created by a gravity field, and the warping of space and the gravity field without the use of particles bending the wave, they used his prediction to predict exactly where Mercury would appear to be shifted to because of the gravity field of the sun. And they made that measurement, and I think with ridiculously high accuracy, it came out exactly where it's supposed to. I don't think anyone could have predicted what was the excess particle field like in those days, back in the turn of the century, 1910 or so, whenever this took place. I don't think anyone could have predicted how many particles are in the vicinity of the sun creating dielectric refraction. So the shift of Mercury was exactly where it was supposed to be, using nothing but gravity field and warping of space. If what you're saying is accurate, it is overly coincidental that the extra particles around the sun were just the right density and just the right density variation that by dielectric refraction bent the wave by exactly the predicted amount. Yes, it's possible, but because that prediction was so darn accurate, I'm getting doubtful. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Well, here again, it's one of those things where, you know, my feeling is that is partially of what Wesley is saying is true, that yes, that there's particles all throughout space, and i.e. you're going to have some density of light because of that. With Einstein's theory, completely agree with that 100%. But here again, you're running into this point to where do you truly have the separation of complete electromagnetic and without mass? There's going to be some, you know, not too many places where this is really going to exist. and the predictions that were made. Is it completely coincidental? No, but I think somewhat yes.
Okay, I hear you.